What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode, nay, a redeployment episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II podcast. On this redeployment episode, we are going all the way back to episode 95. Why? Because today's August 7th, 2024, but we're going to go back to August 7th, 1942 and talk about the first D-Day, and that is the D-Day H hour of when the Marine Corps landed on Guadalcanal. And what better way to do that than to have on a historian who's been to Guadalcanal in modern day. Historian Brian Dmitrovich returns for another episode to discuss his trip back to Guadalcanal, as well as Henry reads passages from his father's book, plus much more. Thank you guys for hanging out and your continued support. We'd like to invite you to head over to whatsthescuttlebutt.com or WTSPWWII.com. Click on that Patreon link, sign up and subscribe. It'll only cost you $1 a month. And we just uploaded some Patreon exclusive content, video content that is, of our podcast. We have the Scott Gibson interview, the full interview, video with quality audio. The entire video is up for Patreon exclusivity. You can see two or three preview episodes on our YouTube channel over at D410 Media, as well as on Patreon, the full interview, the first time Henry Sledge appeared on the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. He shows us artifacts that his father brought back from the war. You can see that entire interview on our Patreon account for $1 a month. Once again, there are two preview episodes on our YouTube channel. You can go check those out. And another way you can support what we're doing here at What's the Scuttlebutt is head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the merch link. Buy one of our t-shirts, our coffee mugs, our sweatshirts, what have you. We got plenty of items in the merch store. What a great way to not only show support for the show, but to advertise for us, to let people know we're out there. So head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Sign up for Patreon or grab a t-shirt. And don't forget, YouTube.com, D410 Media. And big news, Jeff did in fact book Dale Dye. He will be on the show the week of the 16th in September. So be sure to bookmark that episode. We'll discuss all things movies, whether it's Band of Brothers, The Pacific, Save It Private Ryan, plus the other projects Dale Dye has been a huge influence on. That'll be a great show. That'll be the week of the 16th coming in September. Thank you guys so much, and on with the show.
Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Dodd Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
New York Times, Dateline, October 4th, 1943. Danish Jews pour across to Sweden. Many refugees are persuaded through Jutland. 1,600 already reported arrested. Stockholm, Sweden, October 3rd. Fleeing the Gestapo terror introduced in Denmark on Tuesday, more than 1,000 Danish Jews reached Sweden, most of them by last night. Braving the icy Orsland, Jewish refugees of all ages and condition arrived on the Swedish coast. Some even swam the strait, 2 miles wide at its narrowest. Others were rowed across by Danish fishermen who charged $375 to $750 for the passage. Not all those who have tried to cross have succeeded. It is thought probable that most swimmers were seized by cramps and sank. Others crossing in boats were surprised by German Navy mosquito crafts patrolling the straits, and their boats were sunk by gunfire. The refugees said that when the Gestapo intruded on their New Year celebration, some Jews had resisted, and both sides had many, many killed. Municipal authorities and Red Cross branches in the coastal communities in southern Sweden are lodging and feeding the refugees in schools and other available buildings. Many are destitute. Copenhagen reports said that the Gestapo had concentrated on poor Jews, apparently giving those who could afford a huge ransom a chance to negotiate. Travelers reaching Sweden tonight said that Heimlich Himmler had arrived in Copenhagen to superintend the roundup of the Jews, but this has not been confirmed by any other sources. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. And Jeff is not with us tonight. He is out doing whatever he does when he's not here. But we do have Henry Sledge once again. And returning to the show, it's been a year or two. I think he was on season one, Brian Dmitrovich. Sir, how are you doing tonight?
Good, good. How are you guys doing?
Good. Real quick, you know, Henry, we talk about a lot of books on this podcast, and people listen like, well, where does he get a New York Times story for October 3rd, 1943? One of the coolest Christmas presents anyone ever got me when I worked in radio, the host of the show I produced, the Stan Haney Show, he got me this book for Christmas, and he's like, this is literally every single story ever published in the New York Times from 1938 to the end of the war that had anything to do with World War II. And
wow.
I used to do this occasionally. I want to start doing it more. Is I'll go through here, say, okay, what day is this podcast going to air, or what day we're recording, and I'll find a news story from that day that isn't 3 pages long. And so that was what was going on this day in 1943. And think about that for a second. You're a bunch of Jews outrunning the Gestapo. You get to near Sweden. There's an icy river. Your options are to swim. And as you heard, most of them died from cramps. But there's some fishermen there who will happily take you across for $350 to $750 1943 money. That is insane.
Inflation.
Yeah, I guess. But anyhow, so I am beat. I am sore. Yesterday was a weird day for me. About 5 months ago, and we don't talk about too much on this podcast, but just to give you guys an idea where I'm at. 5 months ago, I signed up for an OCR race that I've forgotten all about. It was only a 5K. And I joke, it's kind of like you're my first OCR, which is obstacle course racing. That if you guys aren't familiar, I do savage races. But this one's called Rugged Maniac. Here's my medal. It was up in Tampa. 3 miles, 25 obstacles. But since they were easier obstacles, quote unquote, I was able to actually do them all in the first time and finish the race in 33 minutes. But I had to get up at 5:30 in the morning, leave Cape Coral at 6, get there in order to warm up, run a mile, and get to my wave time. Did all that. Drove back home 2 hours, ate lunch, and then I had forgotten that I just kind of got in touch with a guy I went to high school with in Grove City, Ohio, who joined the Marines. He was a tank commander, served 3 tours in Iraq and then a tour in Afghanistan, had been blown up, his tank's blown up by IEDs multiple times. Before retiring, he joined the Wounded Warriors Division. Has nothing to do with the Wounded Warriors Project, but the Wounded Warriors Division, and then retired out of there. And so now he lives in Northport, which is only 30 minutes from where I live, which is crazy that we all grew up in Ohio and then moved down here. And so after getting home, doing this obstacle course race, being super tired, he came down with his kayak, and then we went kayak fishing for 4 hours. And it was so weird to see someone I hadn't seen since June 6, 1997. But we had a good time. I went out and caught a 2.5-pounder and then got up today, was tired. Me and the wife went out kayaking again today.
I was about to say, I thought I saw you post something on Facebook. You were on the water again.
In Cape Coral, we have over 5,000 miles of canals.
There used
to be a joke back in the day about people selling swampland in Florida. That's here. Cape Coral was developed by two brothers who actually started in the, I was going to say pharmaceutical, but cosmetic industry. And so they decided, hey, land development's where it's at. And so they came down to Cape Coral, Florida, paid to dig a bunch of trenches, drained the place, started selling some land, made some money. And there's a great book called Redneck Riviera. Not to get off topic of World War II, but hey, what the hell. Then they decided, you know what? This worked pretty well, but our profit margins weren't quite where we'd like them to be. So then they bought up an area that has now been called River Ranch Acres. They basically took out some trees, put in some service roads, and then went up to Ohio, Cleveland, and New Jersey and sold the property as being part of a fully developed city, which it wasn't. And then long story short, the property got taken over and turned into a private hunting facility. And the author of that book went to claim his dad's land, built a cabin. His cabin was shot up, burnt down. His Jeep was shot up, burnt down. Long story short, the state of Florida took over the property, and people go hunting there now. But the Rosens brothers finally went to prison for just bamboozling people. But to answer your question, because we have so many canals, I have 3 fishable lakes within a mile from my house. So I can come home, load up the kayak, and be out on the water in 15 minutes. And it's once you buy all the gear, don't need gas money to kayak. And so it's like, hey, let's go out and do something that won't cost us anything. We'll have some fun and we'll get some vitamin D from the sunlight.
So, I thought when I first got into this gig with you guys, you told me you were really into doing a lot of fishing and posting fishing videos. So that's
I just started fishing in April. I've caught more fish down here in April than I did all the times my dad took me out fishing in Ohio. We'd go on a pontoon boat and we'd go out at midnight. Oh, we're going to catch some blah, blah. We catch some catfish and all that, but never anything. I've caught in probably since April, well to 100 bass down here. We have so many of them. You can keep 15 a day under 16 inches. They just want to get rid of them all.
Nice.
How's your week going, Henry?
It's been good. Been pretty busy, but we're getting ready to go to the beach next week. We're going to go down to Grayton Beach. So that's going to be nice, keeping my son, or my son keeps me busy, I should say. So, you know, it's going pretty well. I've had some nice weather, but it's gotten rainy over the last couple of days. So,
Brian, you're back on the show. And I know last night they aired an episode of World War II TV in which you were on, and you were talking about John Bazelon. And you and I were talking last week about having you on the show. And then Jeff said, hey, I won't be able to come on this week. And I thought, well, what a perfect time to have Brian on because he wants to talk about John Bazelon, which Jeff loves, but he's not here to hear it. So, haha. So give us a little update about how you got hooked up with World War TV, 2 TV. And then let's talk some John Bazelon, because with the exception of a little bit of what we talked on about him with Jeff, we really haven't given him a whole lot of credit on this podcast.
Yeah, so a good friend of mine, Paul Woodage, he started a tour company in Normandy years ago. I want to say he's probably been well over 20 years in the Normandy area, and I've been to Normandy and touring with him over the years. And then obviously, COVID is driven to a lot of good, you know, digital media content. Mm-hmm. He's always kind of had this idea for something like this. And I think, you know, the whole COVID thing really pushed his hand to do this, and it's turned into something. And he's had some phenomenal guests over the last year. And typically, I think I was actually like the first one to talk about the Pacific on his show, because a lot of his stuff is ETO centric, obviously being in that area.
Sure.
But there is this taste for the Pacific that a lot of them don't know about. So I kind of kicked that off. I'm going to say it was last year sometime. And then he's had some great shows on. They actually did a live battlefield broadcast from Hong Kong, from the battlefields of Hong Kong.
Wow.
The show that just came on, Brian, you said that was done about a year ago.
No, that one was done live yesterday. That was my third time on the show. The first show I did was on Machine Guns. The second one I did was on the Battle of Alligator Creek. And then this one we focused on John Bazelon and Mitchell Page.
Okay.
Now, obviously, most of us are familiar with John Bazelon. Maybe before we get into the Bazelon talk, Mitchell Page, maybe not a name that a lot of people are familiar with. Give us a little bit of rundown on him.
So Mitchell Page was, he was a machine gunner. He was the same rank as John Bazelon. He was in H Company in 7th Marines. And he was about 4 miles away from John Bazelon's position. So again, for everybody to get up on their Guadalcanal history in a very short few sentences, Japanese start building an airfield on the island of Guadalcanal. 1st Marine Division lands there August 7th. And their entire mission is to take hold that airfield at all costs.
Let me stop you real quick, because one thing I just discovered, because I've read Strongman Armed, I've read you know, other Guadalcanal books, but I'm reading one right now, the one I talked about last week about the battle for Guadalcanal, and one of the things that I didn't know, and a lot of people don't talk about, the Japanese Navy built or started to build that runway without talking to anybody. The Japanese Army had no idea it was there. The Japanese higher ups, they were like, good thing for us and bad thing for the Japanese, their military branches kind of acted as sovereign nations. They kind of just did what they had the budget to do. And so I'm reading this book and they're like, yeah, the Navy just decided to build an airfield. And it wasn't until the Japanese Army found out about it that they said, well, crap, this is a good strategic strong point. We got to get some guys down here to fortify it. And so to me, it's just absurd to think that you have an empire with these branches of military who have their eyes set at least on a quarter world domination lined up with the Germans. And yet you have the Navy building crap and doing stuff without telling the Army. We all know that, you know, the reports are always wrong. Oh, they go in, get their butts kicked. Yeah, we sank 2 destroyers and 3 aircraft carriers. And so thankfully for us, their egos got in the way and their fear of being either ran out of office or forced to commit Harry Carey was so high that they just made crap up and did whatever the hell they wanted to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, for people that have served or are part of military families, here in America, obviously there's rivalries, you know, the Army, Navy, you know, Marines, Air Force, everybody. Typically when you get a lot of people from different branches, the ribbon starts. Typically like at a reenactment or a living history, we'll be sitting around a fire. You kind of like back away sometimes.
Sure.
You know, conversations. But the Japanese Army and Navy truly hated each other with a passion.
I've heard it eclipse anything we're aware of in our history.
But to think about in peacetime, that's understandable. But here you are. You're the Japanese Empire. You guys are struggling for resources. Metal's hard to come by. Oil is damn near gone, which is why they attacked us to begin with and started taking over all these properties, because they need the natural resources to fuel their war. And you got the Navy. Okay, let's just clear some trees, use some diesel on our equipment, and just build an airfield without even running it by anybody and seeing if maybe we can get some more equipment down here. To me, it's just staggering, especially in wartime, you know, after you did what you just done.
I think I actually either it may have been in Strongman Armed, which I'm going to finish here in the next day or so. When their airplanes were flying into Pearl Harbor, some of them actually had imported U.S. fuel in their tanks.
That's insane.
I mean, not fully, but some of it was there.
That's crazy. Well, I mean, look what's going on now. I mean, over in Afghanistan and the Taliban and all that stuff. I mean, back then, the global trade wasn't anywhere near what it is today, but here we are. But anyhow, as you were saying, Brian.
Oh, so what ends up happening is there's a big push in August. That's the Battle of Alligator Creek that takes place in September. There's another offensive where the Japanese try to push through that culminates to the Battle of Bloody Ridge or Edson's Ridge. And then in October is where the Japanese and America are all in. They are everybody is saying this is the definitive battle, which is it strikes people when they first hear that, because you think like, well, there's still a chance, and there's not. And that's what's always drawn me to this battle is that America could have lost this battle.
Absolutely.
Half a dozen, two dozen times. It was constantly in the balance. The American government is drawing up plans. They're drawing up speeches that for the demise of the 1st Marine Division. Is this going to be another baton? Do we actually go to the table and start talking peace with the Japanese at that point? So this is the criticality point of Guadalcanal. And in October, it's kind of everybody's all in. And the 7th Marine Regiment lands in September. They actually don't land in August. And part of this is Mitchell Page. He's part of the 7th Marines. And Mitchell Page doesn't get a lot of attention, and it's bizarre. And I had this conversation with Richard Frank, and Richard Frank has written arguably the greatest book on the Battle of Guadalcanal. I mean, it's literally, it's called The Definitive Account. And I asked Richard Frank this there, and I said, I
just got it in the mail.
Why is it that Bazelone, like literally, if you read the Page story, I said, I believe that Page's story kind of starts intermixing in with Bazelone's story and like the, you know, picking up and running with the machine gun. You know, Bazelone does none of that. And I mean, literally, he's laying in between two machine guns and he's rolling from machine gun to machine gun. He has a pistol, and I'm not taking away anything with Bazelon did. Not in the
sure.
least. But Page is literally on a steep ridge by himself. And he has no idea what's about to come up at him. Most of his men are all dead or wounded. He knows what's behind him. He knows the airfield. They're gonna have a direct shot right to the airfield. And he decides to essentially lead a bayonet charge down this hill with a water-cooled machine gun, you know, probably weighing around with the water and the ammo and everything, roughly about 50 pounds he's carrying. And he's able to pull together four or five guys, and he just charges headlong into this Japanese column, just shooting away. And it's enough to freak the Japanese out there to go, we don't know what the hell is coming down at us. And you know, for this, he's going to be awarded the Medal of Honor. His action takes place less than 24 hours after John Bazelon's action. Bazelon's on the 24th and the 25th. Page is on the 25th and the 26th. And, you know, because that's what everybody always says, like, Bazelon's the first enlisted men to get the Medal of Honor. I'm like, yeah, by about 20 hours. You know? But Page is arguably what he does is, I think, far more insane than Bazelon does.
I read somewhere, and it may have been in Strong Men Armed. Henry might know because he's reading it now. I think Leckie covered that. Wasn't he the one who actually burnt his hands? They portrayed it, you know, that Bazelon burned his hand, but it was actually Page, right?
Yeah, yeah, it was because Page, I mean, they were ripping their guns, and he had to pick this thing up, and he does. He, as a matter of fact, we just worked with the American Legion. He's actually from the Pittsburgh area, Charleroi, to be exact. Over this summer, I worked with the American Legion, and we dedicated a memorial to him in his hometown, which was kind of amazing to all of us. We're like, how the heck does Charleroi not have a monument to Mitchell Page? And got to meet some Marines that knew Mitchell Page.
Wow.
And had photos when he was in Pittsburgh and he was at the American Legion talking. And there's photos of him with the scars still on his arms from the machine gun.
I think, Henry, to answer your question prior about the fact that Bazelon kind of got, you know, perhaps maybe his reputation got inflated. Obviously, it's nothing that he did. I think maybe it was part of the quote-unquote propaganda machine on our side. We got Bazelon going on tour. He's trying to raise war bonds. How better to get more people out than to just kind of take both these stories, mix them together, and create, you know, we'll use Bazelon's face and name and, you know, create this superhero mentality just so we can sell more war bonds and get more money and supplies to back the effort. You know, history be damned.
It might have been a thing where somebody thought that John Bazelon was a little more charismatic than Mitchell Page. You know, sometimes things break that way. You have one guy who just, he's just got that air about him that, and somebody goes, hey, he's our guy. We can market that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, not to take anything away from either one of them.
Sure.
Absolutely. And I think, too, you know, I've had this discussion before. I think it all depends on who's pushing it to. You know, it's like, you know, where I work at, you know, if you put in, we have awards that are given out at the end of the year. You know, managers will put in for the awards, and, you know, certain managers will, you know, they're able to wordsmith things to make things sound better. You know, I'm sure this happens all across corporate America and then, you know, anything else.
I've never encountered that.
But you know what I mean? It's like, depending on what you got Chesty Puller, you know, that's already a Marine legend in his own right. By the time Guadalcanal hits, that, you know, Chesty's going, no, it's my guy. I want the attention on my guy. And again, I'm not saying that this happened or anything, but it's still this kind of mystery where, you know, like Bazelon becomes, he was already a household name before. It's not like, you know, obviously he goes into Marine lore. I mean, after the heroic deeds and being killed on Iwo Jima. And
can I read the last sentence of this chapter 14, Strong Men Armed?
Absolutely.
It was the hush that comes upon the end of battle, as eerie as that long white snake-like blister that ran from the fingertips to the forearm of Platoon Sergeant Mitchell Page.
There you go. And, you know, I was going to think, we as historians, and, you know, especially people like me and Brian who do Living History Now, we kind of look at history as in, you know, done a certain way. It could have been something as simple as somebody came down from the War Department saying, hey, we're looking for somebody for a war drive, preferably a Medal of Honor recipient. And the person asked us, said, what's his first person came to his mind, that Bazelon guy. It could have been something that simple.
Give me him.
Yeah, it could have just been, I wrote up some papers 2 days ago. What was it? John Bazelon. He'll work. Yeah. It could have been something that simple and not nefarious. We don't know.
But again, not to take anything away from John Bazelon.
Oh, sure. No. Not at all.
No. It was like, well, like what I talked about on the show yesterday. So, you know, the narrative always is that he's taking on 3,000 Japanese, and for some reason he's like, he's barefoot, and you know, he's going 3 days without food, and you know, and this doesn't even happen, and he's actually going up against the 9th Company of the 29th Infantry Regiment, and they're coming at him with 130 guys. Now, Bazelon only has 4 guys with him, so it's essentially, you know, 5 on 130, which is still insane.
Absolutely.
At that point, I'm probably needing a change of clothes.
Dungarees.
At that point, I mean, hell, if it was like there's 20 guys coming at you, I would still be utterly terrified. You know, again, what he does is, I mean, he keeps those guns going. He keeps the ammo coming. Alone, Bazelon, between his 2 guns that he fires on that right flank, fires over 60,000 rounds of ammunition just out of the 2 wow. guns.
And how many?
I mean, that's from his own testimony. I mean, we were able to actually come across his Medal of Honor testimony, and you know, he just walks it down through of everything right. he fired and what he did, and you know, again, just doing that at night. If you watch the show, I have some of the video of his. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is just dense.
Brian, have you ever heard of Joseph Alexander, Colonel Joseph Alexander?
No.
But he wrote Storm Landings. He wrote Utmost Savagery about.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Joe was a friend of mine. I went with him to Peleliu in 1999. But he and I talked about the Pacific several times after it came out. And again, not to make the show all about the miniseries, not that that's a bad thing, but, you know, we were talking
I got my travel Peleliu shirt on.
I saw that. But I asked Joe, like, okay, Joe, what were your thoughts on it? How'd you feel about it? And he said, and he liked it, but specifically, what really sticks out of my mind was him talking about Bazelon's fight there in part 2. And he said, I think that was as well represented as I've ever seen it, hands down.
Yeah, because when you watch that, it's not the heroic comic book version where he's running around barefoot. He's doing realistic things. He's cleaning a jam out of gun. He's making the guys are shooting. And what I want to ask Brian, or maybe Henry knows this, I don't know the nomenclature of the machine gun that well. For people trying to figure this out with the amount of ammunition you said he expended, how many rounds does a belt hold on the water cooled 19? What is it?
1917. 1917. 250 rounds.
So think about that. 250 rounds.
Okay.
Yeah.
And obviously he's an expert with this gun, but you still have to change that belt. There's still time in there. Just think about how many times he had to change those belts on those guns to expend that many rounds. And
right.
when you're doing that, you're hoping your gunner assistant's laying down some fire with his M1 to give you cover. But that's still an amount of time that machine gun nest, which everybody on the other side is aiming at, because the machine gun nests are what you try to take out first.
Absolutely.
And every time you're changing that belt, that's you're at your most, you know,
vulnerable. Yeah.
And just that in and of itself is just tremendous.
Doing it in the dark, and it's everything is wet, and you're sweaty, and your adrenaline's pumping.
And you're laying in a foxhole with hot brass all over you, because that stuff's just expending all over you.
Oh, yeah. it's just dumping all over the place. And again, you know, just keeping those guns running. There's also head spacing that you have to adjust for, because when he went to the one gun, he says that it had – he needed to extract a broken shell out of it. And that is completely indicative of the gun not being headspaced correctly. So what's happening is that gun, it's stripping out a round out of the belt and kind of sliding it down into the barrel. And that the barrel is actually screwed into what's called a barrel extension. And they have to set it just right so it kind of slides into that barrel. And if it's off, what'll happen is upon firing or extraction, it'll snap. So it'll actually extract half of it,
wow.
and then the other half stays in, and it won't
and then
allow
stovepipe.
So they actually portray that really well, where he's underneath. Yeah. He's taking a timing gauge, and he's trying to get that piece to flick it out of there. And once he does that, then the gun's back up and running.
And he's doing this in the dark. It's not like they got big mag lights. Maybe at best,
somebody's got a headlamp on. And,
yeah.
On his back, and
somebody's got a Zippo, maybe if he's lucky. But other than that, yeah, he's doing it in extreme dark.
The one thing he said he was terrified of the most was the dynamite. The Japanese used, from my research and the Japanese, they were utilizing their Bangalore torpedoes. And for those that have seen Saving Private Ryan, There's that scene right. where they're bringing up those pole charges.
Bring up some Mandalores.
Right. Yeah, and they're trying to blow holes in the barbed wire, and the Japanese are trying to do the same thing. But what they started doing was they were actually taking the TNT charges, lighting them, and then throwing them over to try to hit the machine gun positions. And Bazelon just said that concussion. He said that was the thing that really jarred him the most. During that action was just that TNT going off constantly, and he would see the pieces.
And also, wasn't it pretty common for like the first Japanese through the barbed wire to just throw themselves on it so their comrades could just scamper up over them?
Yeah, I mean, you're,
I don't know that happened there, but
yeah, I mean, they were. I mean, Japanese were pretty fanatical throughout the entirety of the war, but I always give credit to the 1st Marine Division during that battle in particular, because they're really facing the A-team. I mean, they are facing the best of the best, both at sea, land, and air. You're talking highly qualified pilots. Their Navy is just on point in the night fighting arena. And, it's, again, what they're doing. But it's their tactics that's holding them back. Bazelon, in his own account, says – there are